suppose what we're doing, and increasingly what we're doing in these last few weekends, is just getting to the heart of the whole thing. And I suppose at the heart of the whole thing is this process of becoming present in your body and senses. And as we've been looking at this weekend, present to the seven senses and trusting then what happens. And drawing on, and I guess what we're looking at is understanding, or trying to understand anyway, that as a culture we've massively misunderstood the whole idea of the imagination and the whole idea of myth and image and that tradition. So when you talk about Native American tribes, or when we talk about Fatty Anderson, there's a really interesting book really by a guy called Vine Deloria, who is dead now, but he was a Native American academic and writer, wrote an incredible book called The World We Used to Know. And he's talking about the sort of the ensouled world of the Plains Indian tribes before they became assimilated into white society. And that's not exactly an easy read because he's an academic, but he's written a whole series of books, one of which is God is Red, which is a great title, I think. And he's been a very vocal critic of the core values of Western European civilization. And in particular, what he criticizes is the way in which we have taken the soul out of the world and the soul out of ourselves. Vine Deloria, V-I-N-E is a second word, D-E-L-O-R-I-A. And the title of the book is The World We Used to Know. And in a way, you know, why do we need a course like this at all? Well, partly we need a course like this at all because of the one-sided development of our culture. Truth isn't really like creativity at all. Needs creativity, because all societies need creativity. They need the human talent to innovate, to create the new. But because we live in a society where everything is very controlled and it is deeply suspicious about the whole nature of creativity, because as we know, real creativity cannot be controlled. And in a way, that conflict we were looking at between Taliesin and the court bards is all about the appearance of creativity, which is actually just a sort of a controlling process, as opposed to the raw life that you feel surging through Taliesin, that summons in the elements, that brings in the goodness of the honeymead, that blows the bards away. Now that is, you know, there we're talking about the deep energy of the universe that comes through us, and that you just have to relax into and cooperate with, just as you did in the exercises earlier, in a sense of, in response to Taliesin's bardic law, your own bardic voice wakes up and speaks in your own particular accent and your own particular idiom. Now, if we'd been brought up in a really different society, we'd be much easier at doing that. So, you know, if we'd been encouraged from when we were little children to listen to our dreams, to take our imagining seriously, helped to write poetry, helped to find ways of expressing ourselves that are unique to ourselves, and completely encouraged to do that. Well, these practices, you wouldn't need a course of this, because these practices would be second nature to us. The problem is that they are right from the beginning, particularly if people are interested in these things and certainly demonstrate some capacity in them, then people want to control it or more likely just stop it. You know, so that and of course our religious systems do exactly the same thing. Most religious systems are designed to control people's free spirits. You know, so they're designed to So that phrase we were looking at earlier on from the beginning of the Gospel of John, which is, in the beginning is the Word, in the beginning is the conversation, is the dialogue. Now that conjures an image of an universe and a relationship to that universe where speaking and listening is at the heart of everything. In a way, this is this image of the galaxies that David Spengler has, whereas what our society holds up is the image of the sun and the satellites, and we are the satellites to whatever the core vision of the society is. Now, many centuries of Christianity have gave us the church, gave us the monotheism, the one God, the one truth, and we all have to obey or go to hell. Now, those ideas, mostly in Britain at least, have become secularized, but there still is that idea of the one point of view that is true and sane, and the other points of view that are about madness. And that's an idea that's absolutely endemic in our society. It's why our mental health system is in such a mess, because we do not trust people. You know, we get Lang way back in the 60s and 70s saying that schizophrenia is a process. If it is held properly, if people can go to places of sanctuary and can work through their process, is in itself a creative process. And his initial work on that was very good, but of course it was very labor intensive and therefore expensive, and as a society we didn't want to pay for that. What we wanted to do is to drug people, even though we know that antipsychotics have this thing called extra pyramidal effects that impair people's cognitive function and even their basic bodily reflexes over time. But that was the choice. That's the choice we continue to make as a society. But it's a choice out of a complete one-sidedness, which makes us kind of vulnerable in lots of ways to some of the deeper energies of the collective. Now, almost certainly, you know, without having the skill to work with those energies to make them conscious. When we're talking about the Irish myths, as we were a little while ago, the very fact that at the heart of Irish collective tradition is a war between the north and the south and people stealing and raiding from each other. And then you look at the collective history of Ireland and you see still this massive division between north and south, and reflected later in, you know, Catholic and Protestant, whatever. Well, I'm not saying that's a causal link, but there's an interesting synchronicity in that, in, as Jung would put it, where there's something that is quite strange, isn't it? It's quite strange that at the heart of Irish tradition there is this myth of the north and the south constantly being at war with each other, and they're still sort of at war with each other. You know, if you look at the forces in Northern Ireland at the moment, you know, Sinn Féin and then the Unionist Party are still enacting versions of that war. Not literally so much now, although the VLIRA and some of the extreme unionists are still doing that, literally. But it's strange. I'm not saying it causes it, but I'm saying that's an interesting, unusual synchronicity. Equally, before the Bosnian conflict, when Radovan Karadžić takes his mates up a mountain and gets them all singing songs about the white eagle of Serbia rising to drive out the Turk, and 5 years later he's actually driving out the Turk in ethnic cleansing, that's interesting. Now the bards, if a pre-medieval Welsh bard had been around, what he would have said to us all is that, well, actually these are the spirits of the land are possessing people, are collectively possessing people and are pushing them from behind, because there are no true bards who can help to work and diffuse these energies. Now the challenge of the whole bardic thing, and this is the challenge of Taliesin, and it's our challenge as well, is to treat this creativity that we have seriously. That as we attune to the deep places in ourselves and speak out of these places, our words, our creativity has power. We can bless and we can blast. We can wield the energies of creation and the energies of destruction. And we do all the time. But mostly people do it unconsciously. And the whole bardic training really was really about being able to do this consciously, to pay attention consciously, to listen to the universe, and to enter into dialogue. Now, the dialogues we entered into in this group, of course people know each other very well and are very safe with each other, are dialogues of safety and that enable depth, that enable creativity to arise. But of course we can also be in dialogue with difficult energies, beings that would seek to harm us, beings that would seek to kill us even, maybe. Because that also is an energy of the universe, and so we have to learn not just to work with the creative energies of life, but with the darker, deeper energies of the more difficult energies of life, and learn to protect ourselves in that. And we do that by just coming into our bodies, being present in our bodies. And this is where, in a way, there's a need here, really, to look at different aspects of our human experience, and to bring those experiences together. For example, in relationship to our humanness, you could say, one aspect is our personal nature. My life as Ian, my world as Ian, the people I love and who love me, that is personally part of my life. There's another aspect of being human that is to be collectively human, which is the thing that Jung was talking about, so that almost the archetype of being human. So being human involves two aspects, the sort of collective sense of being human and the personal sense of being human. Another aspect of being Ian, living in a body, is my body is formed of the earth, is formed of lots of cells, and within my body are lots of lives, lots of organ systems, lots of living beings, cells, bacteria, organ systems, all of which have their own life, who know nothing of Ian. You know, they're doing their thing, keeping my heart beating, keeping my blood pumping around, you know, so doing the cellular thing. The organs are doing their thing. My body comes literally out of the universe, out of the earth, out of the stars, ultimately. So there is a sense in which if I'm going to be present, I have to be present not just to Ian's personal life, not just the collective human life, but to the life of the earth. Now the fourth place is, of course, what we might call the transpersonal or the soul place, the place that maybe we come from that's not just Ian in this particular shape. Now, so in a certain sense you could say that Ian is a collaboration between different aspects of life to create this focus point that is Ian, that has this kind of fluid but formed identity. And Ian is the product of a lot of different dialogues simultaneously arising. And what I'm suggesting to you is one of the main features of the human being is that we link together different realms. In fact, we are a synthesis of different realms. We are not pure in that sense. If you look at the purity of an animal, it just does its thing. Dogginess does dogginess. Catness does catness. Bearness and wolfness does wolfness. There is they have their own complexities as well, animals, but actually they are they're different from us in that respect. The animal instinct is in us. But we also have this capacity to bridge, to reflect, to join different realms together. Again, a story from my friend David Spangler, he's a guy who goes very easily into inner realms. And he talks about going into what he experienced as a realm deep in space somewhere. And he found this well in space, so this form that he found with lots of bridges coming to it, and it seemed to him to be this kind of place of deep nourishment, deep in the universe. And at the well that where he was, there was this what he described as an enormous snail. Huge snail that he then had a conversation with. And he realized this snail was another human being. Not a literal human being, but he was a being from some other aspect of the universe. But the reason he believed it to be human is because it also has this essential aspect of bridging between things. Now this is certainly something you find in the Welsh traditions. You find it in the second branch of the Mabinogion, where Brân the Blessed, who is the great king and healing figure, it literally lays his body down to make a bridge. Now being the bridge means that you have to let opposites come together. If you're going to be a bridge between two different places, then you have to be available for the meeting of the different places in you. But you have to be a significant enough vessel to enable that to be held and worked with peacefully in order for something new to emerge. Now this is the image you have of druids walking onto the battlefield, and such is their presence, such is their capability, that everything stops. So they create a zone of peacefulness around themselves within which a negotiation can happen. Now in a way we do that all the time. We continually meet opposites, and if we can just stay present in the meeting of the opposites rather than prematurely choosing a side, if we can in a sense act as the cauldron and use the energy of the sword to clarify the situation, to allow then the difficult opposites to come into the field of our cauldron and stay centered and still and peaceful in that, then something else starts to happen. In a sense, what we do is relax into the cauldron, allow all the elements to relax into the cauldron, which in a way is an image of relaxing into the deeper universe. And as we trust that, then something else happens, and a new dialogue begins. But in order to do that, really, we have to remember to do that. It's very hard. It's easy to do. All you have to do when you are meeting opposites or meeting difficulties and things you just want to, is to, instead of going with the energy of choosing, get present in your body, get present in your senses, and allow whatever it is you're struggling with, whatever it is that's confronting you, to be present in you. And for you to be with it, but not lost in it, because able to, in all sense, almost to lean into the deeper parts of yourself. To lean back into the soul, I suppose we could say. And as we do that, just as when you relax and just trust that kind of flow, trusting the seventh sense, in a sense, these seven senses, the five senses, create the field of presence in the body. As they come together, as we get the sense of being present in the middle of the body, in the middle of the senses, in the middle of the world, we enter the sixth sense, the sense of direct knowing, gnosis. And if we then can sustain ourselves in the Gnostic state and allow whatever the things that we're struggling with to come and be with us in that place, then this is the field of possibility into which the seventh sense can speak and bring in the new thought, idea, word, new energy of creation. Now Taliesin is the image, the archetype of a person who can be this. Now whoever wrote the story of Taliesin in the Mabinogion is writing at a time when these arts are being lost, because the story is all about what is a true bard. Now, a true bard, you discover from the story of Taliesin, has to begin by stirring the cauldron, and is little. And the Gwion, who is the figure that begins the story of Taliesin, is always known as Little Gwion. So there is something there right at the beginning of the teaching story of Taliesin, of paying attention to the small. Pay attention to the little, to little Gwion, whose main function is to keep things stirring, to keep things moving, to not relax his attention. And he has to keep staring into the cauldron, keep the movement, keep the attention, keep the dialogue going, really. Well, meanwhile, Ceridwen, who is the creatrix, who is this great feminine power, is gathering the essence of the universe, bringing everything into the cauldron. And so that's the sort of archetypal scene, right? If you like, the creative energy of the universe is continually bringing things into the cauldron, into this alchemical cauldron, which is going to produce the essence of the universe, the golden drops, the essence of the Awen is going to rise out of the depths of the cauldron by everything being somehow boiled down and essentialized. Now, she does that. There's not Gwion running around grabbing stuff. Gwion's job is just to stay present with the cauldron in the center of things and to keep things turning. And in a way, that is an image of this practice of just sitting quietly with ourselves, with the field, coming in, creating the cauldron. And we create the cauldron by coming into the field of our senses and being present in the middle of experience, letting ourselves be at the center of the world. And the story, the first bit of the Taliesin story is all about being at the center of things. Penachin is where the head of the lake, the lake of lakes, is where they live. The place of, like, the deep water, the place of the origin of everything. And the need of the elixir is to put right a terrible birth. So Movran, or Avagdi, who is the child of Ceridwen, who is the child of tremendous ugliness, whose ugliness is part of the universe and needs to be there. And it's interesting when you look at the early story of Taliesin. We have this cauldron, we have the daughter who is the most beautiful in all the world, we have the son who is the most ugly and repulsive in all the world. So we have all the energies of creation, we have the beauty of the universe, we have the terribleness of the universe. And we have then the creation of this elixir, which is somehow going to not transform the ugliness, but enable us to perceive the beauty within the ugliness. Movran is not going to be made beautiful by if he gets to drink the elixir, but that people will see the beauty that was in the energies, the destructive, terrible energies. So that this act of the elixir is an act of joining, a creation of something that can see the inherent beauty of everything. Now, as we continue to do this, and as various situations are continually put in, and mainly you just keep breathing and keep living your life and keep working with it, but every now and again something happens that's more than that. Something comes to the boil. It's a graphic image, really. Something unexpectedly comes to the boil. It's, because actually Ceridwen has a plan, even so the great universe even has a plan, but also there is a randomness in the nature of things. So when we talk about the movement of the universe, we talk about the deep movement of things, because we are talking about a profoundly creative universe, we're talking about a universe that also has an element of chaotic energy in it. What happens in the Taliesin story is that at a moment when nobody is expecting it, the cauldron comes to the boil. It's finished. It's complete. And these three drops fly off into the air, land on little Gwion's hand, burns him, and he does the automatic thing. He brings his hand to the mouth and sucks. This is a beautiful image of the baby, of the nourishment of the baby, of the imbibing at the level of body. The first nourishment comes by sucking. And here what is being sucked is the essence of the universe. And what happens to little Guyon, little Guyon then becomes completely transformed. He then somewhere is in direct dialogue with all aspects of the universe. And because he is in direct dialogue with all aspects of the universe, one of the things he knows is Caridwen's massively pissed at this point. Because there's only three drops and they've all gone to Guyon and none have gone to Avagdi. Avagdi's name means utter darkness. And in my childhood, there's a sort of a swear word that was based on Avagdi's name, with Achavi. Means, ugh, disgusting.
I never knew that. Sorry, when I lived in Wales for a while, I used to have a Welsh boyfriend, and he used to
do
that, Achavi.
Achavi.
Like something. I didn't know where it came
from. Yeah, well, it's a bit of a slight leap of my part, because Avi means me, right? And so, ugh, it can't be just a guttural, ugh. Ugh to me, disgusting to me, but it's very similar to Avagdi, and I personally, it's got such a powerful root, that swear word, in Welsh tradition. I personally think so this may not be 100% right, but it's a belief of mine rather than, but I like the belief anyway, so I keep repeating it, and it sort of works, but Avagdi is so. Remains, and that's one of the interesting things about this, these stories are never complete stories, they're never perfect closed up stories, because in the whole story of Taliesin, Avagdi remains unreconciled. And there are stories in Welsh tradition of Avagdi or Morvran, as he's also see, who appears and rapes and does terrible things. So he is this energy of the universe that has to be dealt with somehow. But what happens immediately next in the story of Taliesin and sort of is that he sees that Caridwen is coming for him in rage to destroy him. But actually, this is a kind of a catalytic dialogue, really, between Taliesin and Caridwen, where the creatrix, the energy of who pushes evolution onwards almost, in through pressure, through energy, through pursuit. Causes Taliesin to become more and more fluid in his identity, and more essentialized. You find him chased through the earth as a hare, he's chased through water as a fish, chased through the air as a bird, and finally becomes a single grain of wheat, drops into the earth in a sense. And you get this very powerful bit of the story then where Caridwen pecks away at this great heap of wheat, is completely determined to get Taliesin, gets him, swallows him, and this single grain that is Taliesin impregnates her. And there's a great image here about the whole, you know, the identity, if you like, as we move through these different processes of who am I and all of that, we find our identity shifting and changing. And if we continued it for quite a long time, it will get deeper and deeper and smaller and more precise until you get to the single grain of wheat. If you like, the essence, the spark of who we are. And that spark is, of course, in deep relationship with the universe, and impregnates the universe. Caridwen here is the living universe. She is the being who is, but she's the active, dynamic aspect of the universe. And she is this life-death figure. Her name is interesting. Carid, the definition of Carid can mean crooked. It can also mean beloved. So the opposites are united in Caridwen. You could call her the beloved crooked witch woman, or bent woman, the beautiful bent woman, or the creative killer woman. She combines the opposites, yes? She's a figure much like Kali in Eastern tradition. And what then happens is that he gestates in her womb and becomes reborn. So this is a sort of reborn new form, then appears as Taliesin. Up until this point, he's still little Guyon. He then acquires a stable form as Taliesin. And his form is the form of everything. It is not known whether my body is flesh or fish. Fish, the Celts, as Penny was saying earlier, is the great salmon of wisdom. It is that in Welsh tradition, the salmon is the oldest of all creatures.
Because she discards him and throws him onto the sea.
She does.
Yeah. And he lands in a salmon weir.
He does. This is because that's exactly what happens next. She's given birth. She thinks she's going to kill him, but his beauty means that she cannot kill him. So she wraps him up in a sack, chucks him on the great waters, and he is caught as a salmon. He sings this song to Elphin, who is Elphin the Unlucky, who is this kind of figure who is the one of the things about these early traditions is the wealth of a land, the produce of fertility of the land is related to the ability of the king or the lord to be able to somehow nourish the land so the land is fertile. And Elphin is called Elphin the Unlucky because every time they send him out to the salmon weir, he doesn't catch anything. And this time he only catches Taliesin. So there's a great song of Taliesin. Says, you're not so unlucky now because now you've caught the great salmon. Now you've caught the being that actually is all being. And then what happens in the next bit of Taliesin's story is a whole kind of drama around Elphin and his family, where Elphin really does represent. Elphin's a bit like Pwyll in the early stories of Mabinogion. He's a bit tup, as you'd say in Wales, a bit stupid, and he does this thing that. So Maeglin Gwynedd, who was the great tyrant figure of that land. Elphin's at the court of Maeglin Gwynedd, and he boasts that his wife is more beautiful than any other than the queen or anyone that Maeglin has ever slept with. And Maeglin, because he's that kind of guy, gets massively offended by this and flings poor old Elphin into the deepest, darkest prison. And then sends his son Narin to go to the court of Elphin and seduce his wife and prove to everybody his wife is faithless. And there's a whole drama that happens around that. But this is the story that then provokes this challenge of Taliesin to the bards of Maeglin Gwynedd and to the tyrant Maeglin Gwynedd himself. Now, in a certain sense, in a deeper sense, what's going on here is that Elphin and Maeglin Gwynedd and Rin and all and these courtiers represent all these parts of ourselves that dominate us, the tyrant. So the tyrant Maeglin Gwynedd is rather like the tyrant ego. The court bards are all the deceptive little voices in us that try and steal creativity and try and make collusive deals with the world in order to feel honoured and safe. And Elphin is the prisoner in the deep place. Now this is the same figure in a way. He's the heedless figure, but he is the part of us that gets locked up, that is the true king somewhere. Because he is, underneath all his stupidity, just like Pwyll, this man is in a way Penanun. He is a potential master of the underworld. But he is imprisoned, just like the prisoner at the beginning of the poem. And what we see happening there is that Taliesin challenges the false bards, silences them all, and then by calling on the energies of the wind descends down into the deepest place of Maeglin's imprisonment and frees Elphin from imprisonment. And it represents, and that's the process that happens as we let in that creative energy. The prisoners of our nature are set free.
It just occurs to me that when the model, the first prisoner, the first golden child prisoner, is free, it is the nuts are on the back of a salmon.
Yes.
They
to God,
the seven,
that's right. That's right. It's the salmon is the freeing energy always, yeah. Right? So they cannot. Yes, in the story of there's a story called the Cuilochan Olwen, where this is the very oldest story of the prisoner, which is Mabon, son of Modrum, stolen from between his mother and the wall, and who is locked up in near Gloucester. And in order to find the oldest prisoner, because this has happened such a long time ago, nobody even remembers what happened. They have to talk to the oldest animals. So they talk first of all to the blackbirds of Cwm Caelod. Is it Cwm Caelod? No. Can't remember, doesn't matter. And the blackbird is a smith. So they have to go to the smithy and to the magical smith bird. And then they go there to the owl of Cwm Caelod. So they go then to the owl, and the owl does know I'm very old, but I can't remember either. They then go to the stag of Rhydenre, who's the wounded stag, and the one represents the great king figures. They can't remember either. He goes to the great eagle, and great eagle can't remember. But the eagle says the one being who will remember is the salmon of Llynclw, for because the salmon is the oldest of all beings on earth. And so they go to the salmon, and the salmon's got all these spears in him from lots of people trying to get him, and he's this most ancient, massive great salmon, so big the knights can ride on his back. So they ride on his back, and he swims into the fortress and frees Mabon, the son of Modron. So it's the same image, very ancient image, right, of that kind of bardic, creative kind of energy. And as we become the salmon, or as we let the salmon guide us, the prisoner is let out of prison. And then a new cycle begins, something next, that, and a new dialogue happens. Now all this is very complicated, because you can get very wrapped up in the myths. But the myths are just reminders of something, really. They're just pointing us. What they're pointing us to is this capacity to just get present with yourself, to come into the seven senses, and then to follow the process that then just naturally unspools from there. So we can forget all of this, but as long as we remember getting present, letting the five senses coming together, entering the sixth sense of direct knowing, and then following the process, the creative process of dialogue that then arises out of that place. And trusting the dialogue just step by step, that's truly all we need. The other stuff we need, because we need the reminder, we need the help, it's not essential. But we need the help, and certainly as we come to the end of this course, the key thing to do is to just notice what are the useful reminders for you. What are the things that speak to you, and to select from all the various things we've looked at, things that continue to have meaning for yourself, and to let them be your study in a way, your reminder, your place of reconnecting you. I'm always get interested in my friend David Spandler, which I know you hear a lot about, but I'm interested in David's because his path has been so totally different. David's completely uninterested in mythology. Not his thing at all. He's he's quite interested to hear about it, and but his way is simply just to get present in his body and to open himself to dialogue with whatever's around. It's a bit like you doing the thing with the shoes. He will talk to his computer, he'll talk to the tree, or you'll feel a sort of a being from another realm present with him. And he's very much like Alice in Wonderland. He follows the Alice, and just follows. He's an incredibly curious guy, so he's always interested in new things but he's an incredibly modern guy. But he doesn't. He does. You'd never catch David reading a book of old Welsh mythology. I mean, he's happy for the likes of me to do it, but he's not interested.
Does he take what intrigues him down into the deep place, or does he go into the deep place and just see what is there?
Oh, both. I think both. I think sometimes he just goes into a deep place himself, and something appears to him.
Because that's what Jung did, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, what do you? Yes.
No preconceptions,
yes. Well, Jung was a bit different, I suppose. Jung had preconceptions, partly because of his training with Freud. Mm. So he was looking into going into the deep and finding stuff in there. But David's got a much more open kind of field, really. So David will go into the deep place, or he will be interested in dialogue with something that's just very ordinary around him, and that will take him into a deep place. So I think there's a, in a way, I think, you know, the problem with Jung is Jung's very formal, right? So Jung, you know, Jung's experiences in this realm are, you know, he does all, and in a way he's quite cut, in some ways you could say that Jung is quite cut off from it. Well, his personal life is a total nightmare, Jung. This is not an integrated man, right? He was a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant man. Got great respect for him. But actually, if we look at integration, instead of we think of his personal life, it was a total mess. He could never resolve his personal affairs. All the affairs with clients, he had, oh God, he did all kinds of things. But what he did have a genius for was really trusting that kind of deeper place inside himself. But he would access that in quite a particular way. You could say in quite a linear way, I suppose, where he would just drop down inside himself. And then he would still have the same kind of childlike curiosity you find in Alice, where he would just be very serious about whatever he met inside himself and talk about it and deal with it and listen to it and let it guide him. So, but I think that, you know, when we look at Jung, there's definitely a split, you could say, between his sort of deeper self and his personal self, and he never was really able to resolve the issues of his personal self for all his brilliance.
You see, I think, you know, it's the human condition to, our brains are patterned to make stories.
Yeah.
And therefore I think taking these stories in is, I'd rather do that than going blind, if you like, and just see what's there.
Well, I agree with you, because I'm not like David. I'm sort of, intrigues me about David is it's like a totally different, I'm almost intrigued because I can't quite understand how he does it. Mm. I sort of do, but I can't, for me, the stories are the way in, so I like you. When I tell the story, when I tell you, you know, it gives me things I don't otherwise get. But, you know, this place where David can just go and be with, I don't know, the spirit of a tree and just follow it and sort of and in a way create his own stories from that. You know, it's interesting in a way because he was trained as a biologist and he's naturally a scientist. He's not, arts and things and that whole area is not David's world at all. You know, he's very gifted at perceiving the inner world and the inner parts of himself, I think, and has this enormous capacity. I mean, but his way is just so different, and I think from mine that I just get intrigued by it. And I think, you know, difference is always interesting. And I think, that, I suppose, if I just stay with myself and what I think is important, I do think the stories are important. I think it's not, but it's not about becoming a master of mythology or mistress of mythology. Right? Because that's the danger. I mean, you end up in the Joseph Campbell position if you do that. Can't stand Joseph Campbell, to be honest. I just cannot read the man at all. He tries to pack all the mythologies together and you get a terrible bloody mess. Too much information, literally too much information. So for me, I kind of stay with a few stories, the Mabinogion, Taliesin poems, even actually some of the biblical stories, the story of Jesus and the Gospel of John I like, you know, that does speak to me, you know. So so there's something about what, these are things that I lean into to help remind me. They're not the centre of it all. Centre of it all is that practice where you just get present and then follow. Which is why I think David's good for me, because actually that's all he does, and I get a bit. He's also good for me because actually it reminds me that I'm not David. The big danger of this work is trying to be like anybody else. The key thing is you have to be yourself. I can't be David. He's too far. He's useful for me because he just shows me a completely other way of doing it, which I couldn't do really, and wouldn't want to do. I don't think, because I have my own way. But it's refreshing to see somebody else do it completely differently in that way, I think. And so if you ever look on the net and look up David Spangler sometimes, and you just see what you make of him. He's kind of interesting because in a sense he's working in the... Because his whole thing about David is he works with the felt sense. He's different from a lot of psychics who kind of do it in a certain different way. The key thing with David's work is
letting the inner experiences embody, trust the felt sense, and you work outwards and inwards from the felt sense. That's how that's his access point to the deep and the kind of larger world.
There's a film out at the moment, a film of the Finnborn conference a couple of years ago called The New Story.
Oh, right, okay.
Big kind of world conference.
Oh, I remember that, yes.
100 people went and they've actually, it's on Facebook at the moment, a feature-length film of the story of the conference.
Really. Oh, right, okay.
And I also heard that it imploded completely at one point. Anyway, the film mentions that implosion.
Yeah, well,
actually, after it was probably good and expected because there were so many indigenous leaders, people, kind of community activists. You know, so many people: Charles Eisenstein, Satish Kumar,
right? Okay.
Paul Allen from Centre for Alternative Technologies. So I knew personally some of them who went there.
Yeah.
And David Spangler.
Yeah, that he was
there.
Yeah.
Kind of on Skype, and it was. He's referenced quite a number of times during the film, and what's lovely about him is because there's Mexican someone else from the Native American tradition, different traditions, and there's almost a sense that you have to come with your feathers and your gun and your thing in order to have something to say.
Yes, that's right.
Without the universe to speak to us.
Yeah.
And actually, I think it was an amazing experiment because it went there was a big problem at one point where it was a feeling actually that people weren't respecting the kind of so-called indigenous people, and then other people felt that they were just banging on too long and they should stop the destruction of their people and the forest and the this and the that. And it just went on and on and on and on and on. Some people kind of like, stop them talking, let's get back onto the conference. But it was an amazing experiment. But he is someone who just every now and again pops in on the film, almost like he was beamed down and actually talking about this sense that we actually haven't lost this sense, but we don't need the drum and the feather
and
the song and the chant to actually access it.
Yeah, so that's right.
It was very refreshing to hear him within that context.
Yep.
Not saying that one's good, the other's bad, but so we don't have to kind of buy into being an indigenous person of another culture.
Totally, and having to adopt another kind of another persona in order to do that. In a way, that's really something that David holds very strongly.
Is it Houston in America? There are more Druids in America than there are in England, because they feel like a dispossessed people, have European roots, even onto the, 6th, 7th generation or whatever. And how do they become indigenous priests of a land which has got, the Native Americans in it, and Native Americans are touchy, and rightly so, why wouldn't they be? But the fact is the land is there for all now, and we all have to find our own ways of accessing it. And the way to access the land in America is not necessarily the Celtic European way.
No, totally not. No, it's completely different land.
The Native Americans did it because it worked. That's what the spirit of the land said to them.
And actually, it does. People could listen to someone like David Spangler, maybe, because I was kind of watching it with Harper, going, "Oh God, if you really didn't believe, if you weren't kind of sympathetic to this whole thing, you'd switch off after 30 seconds." Because there, of course, is absolutely everything that you would expect, kind of ritual, chanting, singing, drumming, and it's about this new story of humanity and how we're going to kind of live on this planet all together. And so it feels like, there's certain bridges.
Mm-hmm.
in some places, but it's almost like maybe again that voice that I also have again, and then I will watch further, but I know, you know, some people won't.
Yeah.
But with someone like David, it's just sounds like he, yeah, he'd be too spacey and way out for some people.
Oh, Basil, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
for other people just go, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's a very rare spiritual leader who can say, here we are, the way forward is this. And you know, people of a, you know, culture that's been abused, can say, well, they'll always come with an agenda, won't they? Mm. Which will be to hark back to the past and make out, you know.
Yeah, that opposition, the whole thing, which was amazing that the thing happened. I did hear that the facilitators, because Pippa Bondi, who does Way of Counsel, she was there as well, and she did say that the facilitators of the organisers were absolutely in tears at the end and thought the whole thing had failed. But it kind of felt, I don't know, important that actually maybe there's a sense of this grand coming together.
Yeah, it's too grandiose an idea, isn't it? I think.
And a failure, was it success?
A failure might have been a success, exactly. Because actually, if you're going to do something like that, and really reflect the wounds as well, you know, because you could really do a bypassing thing, couldn't you?
Yeah.
And create a new story that wouldn't deal with any of the wounds of the past.
And in a way, the film does that a bit, because it talks about, there was this point, and we moved through it. And then there was almost like a sense of, harmony, lots of good. Yeah.
It's sort of the problem with Findon in some ways, there's a problem with David as well, in that the energies of darkness, or the energies of the non-reconciled energies, are things that get a bit pushed out of the way. In favour of the kind of holisms the things that work.
They made themselves present though in a very strong way.
Well, that's what feels important, you see. So that to me, yeah. And that sounds really successful in that case, because actually Findon is classically a place where they kind of avoid all that. So if that kind of, if you like, that disturbed energy is fully there, well, great. It needs to be there.
Yeah.
You know,
what
and
what they needed rather than what they wanted.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I would think so. Yeah. So I think, in a way, I think the key thing, I think, as we come to the last final weekend, we're going to really look at, well, the next steps in some ways for you all. But so in the month, you know, month to come, whatever else is going on in your life, just get interested in what has spoken to you. And in a way, what will you leave behind, or what would you take with you? Because leaving behind is important as taking with you. Covered loads of stuff over the course of two years, and the stuff is just stuff. But some stuff is useful stuff. You see what I mean? So some stuff is, I mean, most stuff you can leave behind quite happily. But some stuff it'll be important to carry forward in one way or another, because it'll help you kind of deepen your own continuing dialogue and exploration with these things. The other thing you get next weekend is you get certificates of completion from the Anun Foundation. Get some nice certificates from the Anun Foundation.
After this morning, I'd like it embossed with gold.
You'd like it embossed with gold.
We expect the world to be
pretty.
Passing out.
There will be a ceremony, so we will do a little ceremony. So we will do a ceremony of completion. And
is Fergo going to wield her poker?
Wow.
Like she wielded a sword.
She might do. Who knows?
Wondering if we come in character with the tarot cards.
Well, you can do whatever you want. If you want to do that, you can do that. If there are if you're thinking about it, and there are particular things you'd like us to look at in the final weekend, can't guarantee to do all of them because it's only still, you know, it's only 2 days. But let me know, and I'll do my best to assume to meet any requests really. And it's kind of helpful if there are particular things that you've been thinking about that you know, so I can kind of include that in my kind of thinking about how to do the weekend.
Hmm. I am interested interested in the whole, I know we haven't covered it and I know we weren't meant to, but how I love how the way you've interpreted, where you've looked at Jung's work and how you combined it all together.
Yep.
I'd be interested in just a bit more about those ideas from Jung and how they correlate with what we've done. Like, because I know you refer to and mention Jung quite a lot. I don't know, I mean, I guess because lots of people are psychotherapists, they might get it more. I've read a bit of Jung, I don't understand, claim to understand Jung.
I think very few people understand Jung. His writings are very, even psychotherapists, right, I don't. I suppose what I've done is, oh yeah, but sure, I can reflect on that a bit and sort of, yeah.
Because I do love the whole idea of the unconscious and dreams and the story and the whole kind of, the way everything's passed down, all the stories through different generations and how we reinvent those stories again and again.
Okay, good. Okay.